Welcome, listeners, to a new episode of the CASE podcast, another conversation about software engineering. My guest today is Mike Sperber. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Mike, let's start off by you introducing yourself. Who are you and what do you do for a living?
I'm Mike Sperber. I'm heavily involved in functional programming and have been so for most of my professional life. So I started out as a researcher, and currently I'm CEO of a software consultancy in Tübingen, Germany, where we do all kinds of project development and training using functional programming.
Okay. So the topic of our podcast today is going to be, does functional programming matter? And this is actually the result of an interesting conversation we had. We've known each other for a while, and we had a conversation over Twitter, I think, about whether or not the style of programming, functional, imperative, whatever, matters if you look at it from a larger distance, matters in the greater scheme of things. And you definitely do believe it does. And I was sort of skeptical,
yes. Yeah.
Even though I'm a fan of functional programming. So that's going to be the topic of our conversation. Maybe we should start by defining what it is we're talking about. So what is functional programming?
So I think the term originally, of course, I mean, it says function right there in the term. So originally the term was defined as programming with functions. And I think this term was coined in the 90s to distinguish itself from object-oriented programming, where it meant, functional programming meant you could have functions as objects. And most object-oriented languages have acquired functions as objects in one way or another. So it's it's no longer of much use for distinguishing it. But I would say these days functional programming has two distinguishing characteristics. And one of them is that we program with immutable data. And so that, I guess, comes from the other definition of functions, that you have functions in mathematics, where really you just have things that transform input into output, and you don't have the side effects and the manipulation of state that is typical of object-oriented programming. So that's one thing, pure functions and immutable data. And I think the other aspect more has to do with the actual practice of functional programming is in that we really believe in high-level models. So a functional programming language will let you achieve abstraction at a level that is maybe one or two layers higher than an object-oriented language, and we'll believe that that is tremendously useful in modeling. So we use what's called higher-order abstractions that involve functions, and we also use techniques from mathematics and modeling, and which is very different, I think, from the culture in object-oriented language, which is more rooted in sort of looking at real things. Mm-hmm. If that makes any sense.
Okay, so let's maybe elaborate on that a bit. What kind of languages are we talking about here? What are good examples of functional programming languages that you refer to here?
Good examples are Haskell, for example. F Sharp is a popular language on the .NET framework. On the Java platform, you have Clojure and Scala. There's Racket, there's Erlang, there's Elixir. These are all typical functional languages. Mm-hmm. OCaml, I should mention.
So for the purpose of our discussion, does it matter which of these languages people use?
I mean, they all let you do things very differently from object-oriented languages, but they do differ significantly. So first of all, some of these languages are typed and some are untyped, and the typed functional languages typically have very fancy type systems, if you will, that let you do a lot of the modeling using the types built into the programming language. And so usually the models that you build in typed languages differ from those in untyped languages, where you make active use of the fact that they're untyped. So Erlang and Racket, for example, are typical, and Clojure are typical untyped languages, whereas Haskell and F-sharp and OCaml are typed languages. So that's one thing that matters. Really depends on your style of doing business. I'm not very religious about the whole static versus dynamic types discussion, and we aren't as an organization. The other distinguishing characteristic, I think, is the platform that it runs on. And for real-world projects that we do, we generally a large part of the decision which of these languages we pick comes from the platform that the customer runs on their site. So for the Java platform, we would pick between Clojure and Scala. On the .NET platform, F-sharp is pretty much a given. And then the other platforms might be native code platforms, where efficiency might be an important factor, or or other aspects that have to do with platform, operating system, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if the if I look at this ecosystem, if I look at these at this number of languages that we're talking about here, right? There, mm-hmm. I completely agree that they vary very, very much. So is it a useful thing to talk about how modeling changes if you use a language like, or if you use a functional language versus an object-oriented language, or should it be more about whether you use a language that has a static type system versus one that doesn't?
I think there's distinctions in both places. So there's, I think, generally, when we do modeling in functional languages, there's more commonalities than differences. And the difference to sort of typical object-oriented modeling is greater. Having said that, the difference within sort of between static and dynamically typed systems is still significant enough to be worth talking about.
Okay.
But definitely we always do things in a different way from what we would do in object-oriented settings.
Okay. So I think we're going to get into more detail about that. But I find it very refreshing that you're unreligious about this whole thing. So it's not going to be like a Haskell zealot kind of talk. Not that I know any Haskell zealots, of course, but not that they even exist, of course, but the discussion, let's keep it very down to earth. And that's actually what intrigued me in the first place. Right. I've been applying, and my colleagues, my organization has been applying functional programming as well, but it's, I think most of the time, well, these that I know of, I may not know some of the things that some of my colleagues or coworkers are doing, but most of the things that I'm aware of, the choice of programming language is more of an implementation detail. It's not unimportant, definitely not, but it's not the most important decision. The most important decisions are other kinds of decisions, like how do you separate the system into larger subsystems, or where does it run, or how does it manage its persistent data, or how does it communicate with the outside world, all those things. But what you very strongly seem to suggest is that it matters a lot in terms of actually building a representation of the user's or the domain expert's model. Can you elaborate a bit on that? Well, how does that change?
So I think, the most visible change just comes with immutability, right? When you're doing object-oriented programming, you tend to see everything as objects that have encapsulated state, and independent objects in particular that send each other messages. And so that's a very particular outlook on the world around us. And that's very different from functional programming, where we think more in terms of our perception of the entire landscape of what goes on around us. And so so we tend to think in terms of consistent snapshots of our entire system, rather than sort of individual objects that have changing state, that changes independently. So I think that's one change that has a lot of consequences, and I find it hard to overstate those. Those have many architectural consequences on things like testing, on things like coupling. So, for example, if you have state in object-oriented systems, they typically tend to imply a lot of coupling between objects that you don't really see in the signatures of your methods and your UML diagrams and what have you. So that's a very practical and down-to-earth consequence. I think as far as domain modeling is concerned, for some reason, we really tend to try to write things down in code that, at least in their sort of structure and layout, correspond to what a customer would tell us, the structure of their domain objects is like. And I rarely see that in object-oriented systems who tend to somehow always have sort of these evolving objects that change. Even though I think, this idea that you would have a domain model reflected in your software that is recognizably, that reflects the thinking of your customer or the domain expert, is really an object-oriented idea. So in that sense, I think, functional modeling is really just, it's just a hardcore implementation of this idea that we've always had in object-oriented modeling.
So
if that makes any sense.
Well, so let me start with the first half of that argument, the immutability thing. So I think that the common wisdom, at least in the object-oriented languages that I'm familiar with, And I'm not a huge fan, by the way. I'm not a huge, I'm not like an object-oriented zeal. I actually like functional programming. But even within the object-oriented space, I think immutability is now considered to be a very good thing. So if you can make something immutable, you should make it immutable. Yes. If something is a value, then it's a value and the value doesn't change. It's something that refers to that value that might refer to a different value at another point in time. And then that gives you that value object pattern that's very, very dominant, very, very visible in the domain-driven design community, for example. But has also been for a number of years, maybe a decade or more now in many projects. So does that change anything?
That's much older than that, though, actually. So if you look at sort of the design history of object-oriented programming per se, I mean, there's a paper by Alan Kay on the history of object. Alan Kay was the inventor of Smalltalk, or one of the inventors of Smalltalk, and coined the term object-oriented programming. And if you look at a paper he wrote on the history, he said, you know, our goal with object-oriented programming was first to make a more flexible version of assignment, you know, his word for things with state, and then eliminate it altogether. So we're really talking about the natural continuation of the original ideas of object-oriented programming.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that is much older than just the last 10 or 20 years. That's more like 40 years old, that idea.
Oh yeah, I'm sure that's true. I'm just all I want to say is that specifically in the Java space, which I'm most familiar with in terms of object-oriented
language. Somehow that dream got lost, right? We got Java, right?
So I love Java bashing as much as the next person, but I still think that you know, even in C++ or in Java, you can program in very different styles. Yeah. And the mainstream style has changed within the last years.
Yeah.
And I think it's changed towards becoming more focused on immutability wherever possible, because people in the object-oriented community definitely know or understand the value of immutability, I think. So they make everything immutable that they consider it to be a good idea for. So there is some movement in that direction. I think probably everybody can agree on that. Now, the hard part is how do you deal with the cases where you wouldn't make something immutable in an object-oriented language, even if you could? I mean, you could, right? In Java, you can make something, have a constructor, no setters, gets its value once it's constructed, that's it. But you can't do that with everything, because there are some things of course you can, but you wouldn't if you're building a
Think you wouldn't, right? Where do you think you wouldn't?
Well, let's take. And I think we're going to talk more about this. Let's take domain-driven design and the terminology from there as an example, right? So, in domain-driven design, a value object would follow the immutability pattern, right? But an entity or an aggregate wouldn't. Right. So it would allow you to reflect with meaningful methods, not just simple setters, not like, you know, having data holders or anemic data models. It would allow you to do meaningful things to that object that might or might not change its internal state, which sort of is none of your business if you just invoke that method. What's wrong about that?
I think what's wrong about that is really that idea that I described earlier, is that you have entities that are independent of one another, right? In domain-driven design, which I have to admit I don't understand that well, you try to have transaction boundaries in your system that manage, you know, dependent mutations in your objects, but it's always a headache, right? You have this entity, it has state, you call a method on it, that state changes, and in a concurrent world, which we're in, you know, people are going to look at that object and will hopefully see a consistent state, but you really have to take special care to make that happen. And generally, if you look at mutable objects, there's all sorts of consistency issues that you deal with. And so in functional programming, I mean, as you pointed out, in object-oriented programming, it's long been considered a good idea to keep many things immutable. Functional programmers are just much, much more radical about that entire idea. So in order to represent what DDD considers an entity, I mean, especially if you're dealing with pure languages or largely pure languages like Clojure or Haskell, you don't even have an option of putting a setter in there or putting a method in there that will mutate your object. So really, we tend to think of this as, well, you know, we're modeling our perception of some real world or domain entity. The state of that entity changes, and that means we create a new representation rather than changing the old one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So anything that you want to do, any sort of business logic that you write that does something meaningful will always return a new object or a new data, hold record, whatever it's called, a new object as the result of that function, right? So everything becomes okay. So I can see the benefit in that. I can see that that you get rid of the mutability problems, although the problems connected to mutability. And maybe you should explain why that does not create a severe headache in terms of copying stuff all the time. Why is that not a severe performance headache?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, so very often when we have a data structure, even in object-oriented programming, that's internally represented by pointers, right? We don't, you know, when we have whatever, a person object and it contains an address object, or a field of the type address, and the address itself has like street and street number and so on, that typically does not mean that there's going to be a copy of the entire data structure inside the person object. Instead there will be a pointer. And I mean, we're not going to talk about that. Right now I'm not talking about specific programming techniques in C++ where you maybe would copy that. So first of all, so that means that, you know, if I create a new object from an old one to represent a new state, I typically only have to do, well, on the implementation side, you would call it a shallow copy. So I don't have to copy all the dependent data structures. And I really don't have to copy them because they're all immutable, right? I don't have to be afraid that somebody's going to change the address of something underneath. So really it's safe to use it in that way. So that means there is not all that much copying involved as you think. Also, modern functional languages have highly efficient what's called functional data structures. So their implementations of things like lists or maps or sets are functional in a way that if you just create a map from a new one by changing one entry, it will share most of the storage between the old and the new version, and it will do so quite efficiently. Moreover, for quite a while now, especially thanks to Java, people have implemented highly efficient memory subsystems. And the garbage collector, for example, in Java, deals with many new objects being created quickly quite well. So this overhead from functional data structure, I mean, there is some overhead, definitely, but that overhead tends to be smaller than we think, and we have a lot of experience doing that. Mm-hmm. So we don't see that that's being a factor.
Okay, so I've seen this data structures. You call them functional data structures, right? I know them as persistent data structures. Do you have any idea what that term is?
Well, it depends on sort of what era. So the old sort of algorithms community calls them persistent data structure, but then people think of databases.
Yeah.
So the seminal work is just a book by Chris Okazaki, and it's called Functional Data Structure, and that lays out the land on this, and so that's the term that we tend to use.
Okay, so let me try to play devil's advocate here again. Why all of this doesn't really matter that much? I mean, okay, so immutability is very cool, and essentially, you just have to get used to the idea. If I were a long time object-oriented programmer, I would just have to get used to the idea that my functions maybe now don't belong to a class that creates instances of that object, depending on the language I use. So maybe put them somewhere else. Yeah. And everything becomes a parameter, okay? Mm-hmm. And I return whatever I want as the return value. I create something new as the return value as opposed to mutating something existent. Mm-hmm. Now, in that regard, that seems just to shift things a bit around. So it's a different place. And of course, it has a lot of effect because of the immutability aspect, right? Because I get a lot fewer headaches in terms of concurrent access to stuff or weird things happening while iterating over something, and then all of those things just continue to work, and that's pretty cool. So, how do the other aspects of object-oriented programming get replaced, or what replaces them? Let's say, for example, I use polymorphism to create a flexible representation of the outside world in my object-oriented program. What do I replace that with if I use a functional programming language?
I don't think you replace it with anything. You evolve it, right? And you get it just happens that you get different ideas. I mean, to give one classic example from functional programming, which is on the representation of financial contracts, right? And so in a former life, I actually worked in finance on these things. And so you have a complicated financial product, and essentially what it will do is will generate payments over its lifetime according to complicated rules. And sort of in the old world, in the object-oriented world, you would represent this contract as an object, and that object would sort of mutate its state over time to track what payments have already been done or what date it is or something like that. And you would, you know, you would call a method on it to evolve it over time. Mm-hmm. Also, and so we would, and so the actual semantics of the contract would be described by the implementation of a method that would mutate the internal state of a contract, right? So you would have an algorithm, if you will, implemented as part of the method, and you would have some state of the contract sitting in the class that represented the contracts. And, you know, that's all good and well. And in the late 90s, a couple of functional programmers got together with a trader, or the other way around, and thought about a different way of representing contracts. And so first of all, they didn't even have this idea of using an object with mutable state to represent the contract lifetime. What they thought about was, well, I mean, what is a contract, right? And can we describe it in a high-level way that will, you know, that will make the structure and the semantics of the contract clear, that will create reusable components? And so they didn't think about, you know, what happens to the state of that contract as the defining characteristic of the contract. They thought of, what is that contract? It seems a little silly. But so what they did is they developed a little library of building blocks for contracts. And there's a couple of primitive components, like there's a fixed payment of, you know, 1 euro or something like that. And building up from that, you have combinators. And so that's a defining characteristic of functional models, where you build larger contracts from smaller contracts. So you start with a tiny contract that says 1 euro, and then you have a combinator that says, well, any contract I have, I can scale it by a certain factor. And so I could scale something by 10, and suddenly I have 10 euros. I could combine it with another contract of, you know, whatever, 10 pounds, and reverse the direction of that. And so I get a toolbox of small building blocks and combinators that allow me to build smaller contracts from larger contracts. And that is a very powerful idea. It could be an object-oriented idea, but I've never seen sort of the object-oriented community within the banks that I worked for come up with that. Now, so that sort of gives you sort of a static view of the semantics of the structure and also the semantics of a contract. And that leaves open the question, well, how do you deal with the evolving state, right? You still have state that you model. And when you deal with that state, well, we had that idea. You have an object. It has some opaque, internal, encapsulated state. And with this idea of contracts, they came up with a completely different idea that over the lifetime of a contract, well, something happens. The contract generates a payment, and it leaves a residual contract. And it leaves a residual contract as things happen. And so the contract sort of over time gets smaller and smaller and smaller until it expires, when it sort of goes down to zero. And so that's given us a very different view of how these things should be modeled.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I think maybe the analogy, or the way I've seen it done a number of times, the first half of your explanation, is actually that people sort of create an object-oriented representation of a model that represents the contract language. Right, so it seems to be that it's just one added level of indirection here, because if I understood you correctly, what you would do in your version is you would essentially write down the contract in a pretty human readable form, because you would have those building blocks.
Yes.
And the main expert would
be
able to see that. That's sort of the point of the whole thing, right?
Yes, exactly.
And right. In an object-oriented language, what I think you would see is you would see an object-oriented structure being created that represents sort of the same thing. So you'd have some add clause or add rule, or, you know, like, it'll all be object-oriented programming, but it'll be used to create something that would then be interpreted to do the same thing. So it's at a different layer, but it's sort of the same idea of getting something into the hands of the domain expert.
Yeah, so as I said, right, it's essentially an object-oriented idea, but this is not what I've seen in practice, right? In practice, people were all obsessed about the state of the contract rather than the contract itself, right? So, and this is a phenomenon that I've seen over and over again, is for some reason, right, a lot of sort of the semantics of the domain would, in object-oriented systems, would not really be in the objects and their structure, right? But the semantics would be in some methods that contain code that would manipulate the state. And, you know, the code sort of by definition is this opaque thing. You can't look into it. You can't analyze it. You can't generalize it to other aspects. So in a bank, for example, you want to interpret a contract in many different ways, depending on sort of what department of the bank looks at the contract, right? And if you just have a piece of code describe the semantics of the contract, then there's just no way to introspect and to look inside it.
So is that something that you do often? Is the fact that the first of all, I don't know how true that is in other languages other than, for example, the Lisps, right? The Lisp family, I know a little bit. So I think the distinguishing characteristic here is that code is data, and that you can actually manipulate it using the same kind of actions that you would use to manipulate any other kind of data. Is that true for all the languages, or does it even matter? Or were you referring to something else?
No. I was referring to the object-oriented way, right? You would have, a contract would produce a payment. And the way that would work is you would call a method that said, you know, give me whatever happened today, and it would return the payment and it would advance the state of the object, right? But in order to, so that would, for example, be sort of a back office interpretation of a contract. That is the interpretation that the customer sees, right? It generates payments. But other departments, so for example, risk control is going to want to know how that contract sort of behaves on average, or if certain market scenarios happen. And for this, it would be very beneficial if we could look at the internal structure of the method that implements the semantics, but we can't. So the functional model that I just described is the entire structure of the contract, and its semantics is described by the structure of an object that I can look at, right? So I'm saying, you hear me say object, right? It really is an object-oriented idea. Mm-hmm. And of course, I could build the same kind of object. I could build that in object-oriented language, and everybody would look at that and would say, well, this is a really good object-oriented model. But I just rarely see that happen in practice, and I see it happen much more frequently in the context of functional programming. Okay. So I think what happens is the functional languages sort of enable you to do that more easily, and that sort of, you know, leaves, you know, that gives you a little bit more brain brain capacity to think these things, and it also gives you sort of more succinct and more direct abstractions to think in terms of. That you can use, sort of, if you will, the meta building blocks to build the building blocks that you then use to do your domain model, and that's and so that gets us, I think, to the subject of abstraction at some point.
So what you're saying, and just using different words that I probably use, that a functional programming language lends itself very nicely to building something like an internal DSL. An internal domain-specific language is a very natural thing.
All the time.
You can, of course, do the same thing in an object-oriented language, but it's less idiomatic and it's a little harder. And I would completely agree with that. And I agree that a program that heavily relies on this idea of an internal DSL really looks and feels and behaves different than one that doesn't.
Yeah.
So okay. Yeah. We have agreement. Very good. So elaborate a bit. Before we go to the other part, elaborate a bit on the state thing. I'm not sure I understood that. What you were saying was that each action or function that you apply to the contract would give you a residual contract. What do you mean by that?
Yeah.
What is that? How do I have to think about that?
So it's kind of hard to explain in audio. I'll try. Mm. So imagine you have a contract that says, I will pay you, you know, €1 each week. Right, for the next 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. Okay, so at some point, imagine somebody at the bank manages that contract, right? And they look at it today and they say, oh, it's payday. I've got to pay Stefan, you know, I've got to give Stefan his due today. And that means, so I generate a payment, right? At the same time, there's a residual, there is what I call the residual contract, which says that there's only 7 payments left. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that's a new contract. I could just treat that as a new contract that sort of comes out of the old one by removing that first payment. So as the payment as the contract's lifetime progresses and you know, time passes, you know, we get first a contract that has, we start it with a contract that has 8 payments, then we get a contract that has 7 payments, that has 7 payments, 6, and so on, and it goes on to 0 at the end. But each stage here, we just represent it as a new contract, whereas the object-oriented systems that I've seen would typically just say, would just have a state variable that said what day it is, and each time you asked it, you know, what's going on, what's going to happen today, they would look and say, oh, you know, they would look at the same 8 payments because these were in the original contract. They would look at these same 8 payments and say, well, this payment is over, this payment is over, this payment is over, and this payment is over. Ah, and the next one is that one.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
So how would a system build? Okay. So I understand this concept. Mm-hmm. So how would you persist this to some sort of external data storage, like a database? Wouldn't you have to create something in the database that looks eerily similar to the state in the object-oriented program object?
Well, it is state, right? We just deal with it differently. But this is really easy to put into a database because you just find a serialized representation and stick in a field. Maybe that's so that's, I guess, another major difference. I'm not sure how much that has to do with object-oriented programming, but when we put things in the database that have that kind of structure, we don't try to reflect that structure in the structure of the database schema. That would be pretty much impossible because as I said, you have what we call a combinator. So you build a contract from two smaller contracts, for example. So there's a kind of recursion in the data definition for that. And your typical, you know, SQL schema description language just doesn't have that facility. Mm-hmm. So we just serialize it and stick it into a database field, and databases are perfectly fine dealing with that.
Okay. That's a very significant difference to the approaches I know. And then, okay. So, okay, so I agree this has got nothing to do with object-oriented versus functional.
That's more to do with enterprise database.
Maybe, you know, yeah. And it's a bit like what is the common way of doing things, right? So I'm sure you will find object-oriented enthusiasts who will strongly agree that you know, all this whole object relational mapping thing has been and always was a bad idea. Mm-hmm. But still, it's sort of a mainstream way. So many people, not all of them, but many people building object-oriented programs, specifically enterprise programs, actually use that pattern and sort of have a strong relation between the relational data model or whatever database model it is and the objects represented there. So what you're saying is that at least in the functional world you're inhabiting, that is a very different. There's a very different approach to that, and that I would completely agree. Going back to our initial discussion, that is a very significant architectural difference. So if that is the consequence, then things are different. I'm not saying they're better in your version of things, because I see lots of problems with serializing programming language state to databases. But that's a different discussion, I think. That's more of an architecture discussion than a programming language discussion. Okay, very good. So let's get back to a word you used, and you used it as if everybody knew what that is, which was the word combinator. So can you elaborate a bit on, because that seems to me something that you're very that you think is very, very significant and makes a lot of difference in the way we program, not just in that example, but in many examples.
Yes, yeah, we look for that always.
So what's a combinator?
Yeah, so what's a combinator? So a combinator just isn't, it's just, it's a function that takes two A's and produces an A, where A is some domain object or entity or value or something like that. So that's sort of the purest form, is you combine two things into a larger thing. And the significant thing is that really the same kind of thing comes out as goes in. Mm-hmm. Right. And here's a significant difference in practice. So if you have, you know, any enterprise-y, you know, database-based system that you look at, it's typically going to have a hierarchy of domain entities, right? So there's going to be, you know, whatever, you have an insurance company and it has some building block for a contract, and then it has a contract, and then it has a portfolio, and I don't know, something. So you have a hierarchy of terms, and usually what happens is that when you want to combine things from a lower part of the hierarchy, you will end up in a higher part of the hierarchy. And this never loops back. And this So you can't, you know, if whatever a portfolio is at the top of your hierarchy, you will have there will typically not be a way to combine two portfolios into a portfolio or into something larger. So this sort of hierarchy or this pyramid will have a tip at some point. Mm-hmm. And so that, in our experience, creates, well, first of all, it creates a proliferation of sort of domain language where you have a lot of words and that don't really describe fundamentally different things. And also it creates a very rigid structure. And the day always comes when a customer wants to combine two things that can't be combined within sort of that this hierarchical taxonomy. And so this general thing that we try to look at in functional programming, we try to reduce the number of different domain entities that are in our system. And then we always look for combinators to combine two of those things into yet another thing. And then I can combine that thing with another thing, and I can do that indefinitely. And so that leads to structurally simpler models, first of all. And it also leads to much more flexible models, because typically... this restriction doesn't exist. And usually what also happens is that, when the domain model will strongly suggest combinations that don't yet exist in the customer's idea of the domain, but that could. Just the language of, enterprise database schema thinking just hasn't been able to express it.
Mm-hmm. So can you walk me through an example of where this hierarchy occurs and so that we can contrast the two approaches?
Yeah, so my favorite example occurs in so we do a lot of business writing systems and for semiconductor fabs, for systems that control semiconductor fabrication. And so making a semiconductor means that you go through a lot of steps. So a microprocessor goes through about 1,000 production steps. And what you can have is within those 1,000 production steps, you might have a subsequence that if you start it, it has to finish within a certain amount of time. Otherwise, some chemical process will destroy your wafer. And so the way to think about it is that the way that sort of traditional systems in that space work is they say, well, so one of these this sequence of steps is called a route, and a route consists of steps and then these so-called queue time zones that describe that subsequence that needs to finish in a certain amount of time. So there's a couple of steps, a queue time zone, a couple more steps, another queue time zone, a couple more steps, and another queue time zone. And so now you have two entities sort of that are hierarchically arranged. So a route consists of queue time zones, but a queue time zone can't consist of routes. Mm-hmm. And so to us, when we started writing a functional model for this, it strongly suggested to us that we should be able... So when we think of, well, what does a queue time zone consist of? And in the traditional model, it said, well, queue time zone consists, again, of production steps. But really thought, well, there's this funny thing is that we can have production steps in a route and a queue time zone, so that really suggests that those two things should be the same. So that a queue time zone should not just consist of individual production steps, but really that a production step should either be an individual operation, put something into a machine, take it out, apply some chemical process to it, but should also be able to be a queue time zone. So if that didn't mean anything to you, that model immediately suggests that we should have queue time zones nested inside of queue time zones, or from a combinator perspective, that we should be able to combine multiple queue time zones into one. And so that's an idea that sort of came out of the programming language representation of these semiconductor fabrication routes, but that weren't present in traditional models that customers had of that route. And so we went back to the customer and said, well, our model suggests that really queue time zones, they should be able to nest. Then we could have a combinator and we would be able to build much more elegant software. But does that make sense in your domain? And they said, yeah, absolutely. And if you think about it, it does make sense that, that you might have subsequences that have their individual constraints on time. And so that's my favorite example where we would sort of gain new domain knowledge almost. Just because we expanded, what we could represent in our software model from what previous models were able to do.
Okay, so I think there are two ideas in there, and mm-hmm. I think one of them might mm-hmm. be achievable if you weren't using functional programming. So let's say if I analyze the domain, I recognize this same relationship that you recognize, mm-hmm. that there is a this structure,
mm-hmm.
And I simply decide to arrange my domain entities in sort of a composite pattern that allows, you know, I have a super abstraction of some kind that's the generic step or whatever, and generic steps can nest, and then obviously these others can nest as well. So I might discover the same relationship, and if I went with this model to the domain experts, they might agree in the same way, and I would have helped them to get a better system. But I do think there's a second thing that you don't get as easily in the object-oriented world, which I'm just guessing here, seems to be that that this combinator isn't really specific to this particular scenario. It seems like the combinator approach is something that you seem to see and apply everywhere. It's like the essence of the composite pattern. Well, not the composite, but the essence of this could be applied to everything, and it's only complete if it's this way, and because you see that there's something missing there. It's like a missing element in the periodic table or something. It suggests there needs to be something here, and then it's easier to find. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, that's a beautiful summary, and it goes beyond that in that, well, if you have a combinator and that combinator is a function, so that maybe gets us to the next subject, is if you have that combinator, we can then look for mathematical properties of that combinator, right?
So what are some examples of that?
From school, I think we might all remember associativity, right? If you have, and so we know that sort of plus and times, and so addition and multiplication are associative operators. It doesn't matter which way you put the parentheses. Mm-hmm. And so the next step after we found the combinator is always to look if our combinator is associative, because that will give us, it means we can learn something again about the domain. It's a particular way of thinking about the domain. And it also allows us to use the combinators in more flexible ways. And sometimes that is just more domain insight, and sometimes that's very practical things. So, for example, when you do a lot of aggregation in big data systems, and you do that in a distributed setting, then associativity is exactly what you need to do in order to sort of distribute your computation in a tree shape.
Mm-hmm. So what are, when you say those are functions, what are typical names for those functions? Would they be?
That are associative,
or no? Just the kind of combinators that you find. What are names that you come up with, or is it always the same names that you use for those?
No, it's not always the same name. So to give you, it really depends on the domain, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes the combinator is just going to be and, right, mm-hmm. where you have two things. So in the financial contracts, for example, there's one combinator that is and, so you have two contracts with certain rights and obligations, and will just combine those. And however, in other settings, one classic setting is, for example, with images, right? And again, in an object-oriented setting, you tend to think of images, well, usually the way images are done is you have a canvas somewhere, and that canvas is your object, and it will have methods that will draw pictures on that canvas, that will mutate the state of that canvas to make some shape visible. And really, again, in functional programming, we think of the pictures as objects, and we make pictures by combining smaller pictures.
Well, you would do the same thing in an object-oriented system as well, I think. You would have an image object or a picture object, and you would merge pictures.
From us. I think this really is just, is just a continuation of that idea of object orientation, that we have objects to represent the things that we recognize in our domain. So you can combine pictures in different ways. So there's different combinators that we that we can imagine. So we can put two pictures on top of each other. We can put overlay two pictures, or we can put them beside each other. And then actually we will have different combinators, and they might be called something like beside and overlay and above, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, and that would reflect what goes on in the domain.
Right. So in that object-oriented version of the image library, I would have a super class, the basic image interface class that sits atop on top of all or above all concrete implementations, and then that interface would have signatures for all of the operations that I can use with images. And your Yes. Functional model, those would just be free functions, right? That can be applied to things to the left and to the right of that combinator to yield something new that would be the same thing. So again, it's possible to do the same thing in the object
OOP
system, but it's maybe more common in yours. Okay. And I understand, I can see how if you give them names that you already know the semantics of, like and, then it's kind of obvious that associativity is one of the properties that you should have if you call it and.
Yeah.
So what about the other properties?
So you mean other than so associativity is like always the first thing that we look for, right? It's we look for a combinator, we look for associativity, and then we sort of go up a hierarchy. So the next one up would be to look for what's called a neutral element, right? And so we use functional programming lends itself to performing algebra, and so we look at algebraic structures for inspiration. And so there's an algebraic structure called a monoid. And a monoid is just something where you have an associative operation that has a neutral element. A neutral element is, for example, when you do addition, then that would be zero, right? You add zero to a number, you get back the same number. So it has.
So is zero the monoid then, or?
I'm sorry?
Is zero the monoid, or?
No, the zero is the neutral element of the monoid.
Okay.
So in algebra, usually what you say is, well, you have terms like monoid or semigroup or group or something like that. And what that usually refers to is you have a set of things or a type of things or a universe of things, and you have some operations on those things. And as I said, the first operation that you always look for is a combinator, something that will take two things and produce another thing. And then you will look for equations that describe how that operation works. So, for example, simple equation is A plus zero is A for, you know, any A, for example. And that's that really what makes up the monoid. It says, well, you have a set, you have a combinator, you have one particular element, and you have two equations that describes what a neutral element is. Mm-hmm. And another one for associativity, of course.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
So, and let me, if I can point out one more thing, it's that sometimes you will come up with a combinator that is not associative, right? But that could be if you twiddle with it a little bit. And that's usually a sign that you should actually change your combinator to be associative. And so that really is a powerful design guide, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Okay, understood. Are there other relevant properties that will help you?
Oh, yeah. There are lots of them. So typically, the next step up, I mean, there's the sort of, whoever's been in an algebra class in math might recognize that there's a hierarchy going on. So there's a semigroup, which just says associativity. Then there's monoid. Then you might also look at groups, but groups are already considerably rarer than monoids are, for example. But you might have a commutative monoid, which is also very, very useful, where you know, it says A plus B is the same thing as B plus A. So that's how you go up in that hierarchy. The next level that we tend to look at is, so I have this next rule after look for the combinator is we look for a functor. And everybody's seen a functor, I think, in a modern object-oriented language, is in that you have a collection of A's, you know, a list of A's, it will have a map operation, right? And these, of course, they come from functional programming originally. And the map operation says, well, I have a list of A's, and I have a function that turns my A into a B, and that will apply that function to each element of that list and give me a list of B's back. So it will sort of apply a function inside a container, inside something that contains A's. And that's a very general idea. And if you look around, for example, in the Java class library, you will find this map operation in classes or in interfaces that ostensibly have nothing to do with each other. But it's always the same idea. And so, for example, in Java, optional and stream both have a map method, and you recognize sort of very, very related signatures there. So this idea also has a name, and that name is called functor. And so that's the next thing. Look for a combinator, and then, you know, once you found the combinator, you look for a functor.
So wait.
Yeah,
I need to ask.
Yeah.
So I'm familiar with the map thing. I think basically everybody who's used a modern programming language is that.
Yeah.
Not, they don't even have to be functional programming enthusiasts, because every mainstream OO language has those things as well.
Yeah.
But you seem to, again, be suggesting a different thing than just using that as something that's in your collection class library, right?
Yes, absolutely.
What you're saying is you're discovering those things in the domain.
Yes, exactly.
So help me find a map operation in a business domain?
So,
I mean, this is, I understand the generic map operation that's sort of defined in the context of lists or data structures or any sort of data structure that's a set semantics.
So it kind of surprised me too, because if you think, as I, you know, as I pointed out, it's very generic. I just briefly want to hook to your question, right, which is to look for equations. And this map, it's not just a type signature that map has. It also needs to fulfill two equations that come with functor, right? And one of those, the simplest equation is one that says if you apply identity, the identity function, if you map using the identity function, you get the same thing back. Mm-hmm. So, but having said that, how do you discover? So, how do you discover a functor in your business domain? Well, the way to do that is, so you've got a colleague Lars Hupel who has a great talk, said, you know, better one more type parameter than better a type parameter than no parameter or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that's what you need for a functor. You need a type parameter. And so what you do is you look in, you know, the type definition for your business domain entities or objects, and you look for something that would be a good candidate for a type parameter. So that might be something like, you know, if you have something, it might be something like the currency or something, you know, if you're doing dealing with finance things, that suggests that it could be a different thing. You know, just the other day we did, so I always do a domain example where we model animals on the Texas highway. And it's supposed to demonstrate this idea of functional programming where you have state by just always producing a new object. So I never thought about it in these terms. And then somebody said, well, you always say, look for a functor. Where's the functor there? And so the idea with these animals is they all have a weight field. So they all have a certain weight. And then there's a function or a method on these animals that feeds them. And so what you then do is you just stick a type parameter there, you stick a generic there where the weight used to be, and then that is immediately a candidate for, oh, okay, now I've got a type parameter, I could try implementing a map operation, and that turns out to work really, really well. And then you look for what you can do with that. It will give you something else, namely that where there was a concrete type before in your, you know, business domain representation, it now has a type variable, so it doesn't say what it is anymore. If you have an operation that doesn't put a concrete type there, you will have learned something, namely that that operation will not mess with that particular field. And so that gives you insight again, maybe a small morsel of insight, but insight nevertheless about your domain object. So you just stick a type variable there, see where it takes you, and in surprising ways, it might actually work out, and it often does.
Yeah, so it's taken you until minute 50 to completely lose me, but you have now, so you need to catch me again. What is it that you're saying? Walk me through that animal example again.
So an animal example. So yeah, let me do the complete example. It's not that complicated. So on the Texas highway, there are two kinds of animals. One type of animal is an armadillo. And each armadillo, you know, has two properties. It's either dead or alive, and it has a certain weight. Mm-hmm. And there's also rattlesnakes. And rattlesnakes, each rattlesnake has a certain length and also a certain weight. Mm-hmm. Okay? So they have a field in common. So in the sort of initial version of that domain model, that weight field would have type, you know, double or int. Mm-hmm. Or you would define a type using units or something like that. Or maybe not units. You would just stick stick an int there and say that means, you know, that many kilograms, mm-hmm. right? So now this idea of look for the functor suggests that you take out that int type and you put an A there, right? Mm-hmm. You just stick a type variable or a generic there. And then you change your type to no longer be animal, but animal, you know, angle brackets of A. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
No, that makes perfect sense. Yes.
Right?
I can parameterize my class or my system.
It's rather arbitrary, but it seems, you know, weight seems a little bit more important than the other things in that domain model. So that's a good candidate for sticking your generic thing there. Okay. Mm-hmm. Then I can immediately, so I get immediate advantages from that, somewhat surprisingly. As I said, my students took me there. So one of them is that, you know, a DDD expert is going to look at this and say, well, you stuck int there, and I don't know what that int means. Does it mean kilogram, or does it mean gram, or does it mean whatever? You know, what's the unit here? And so I could then immediately stick a type there that will be more specific about the unit. Mm-hmm. So that's an immediate benefit that is not abstract at all. It also allows me, so for example, there would always be a method that would feed the animal. and that would mean it would affect the weight. Mm-hmm. So you know, you would get an animal. There would also be a method that would run over the animal with a car.
Poor thing, right?
So if you look at, so again, because we're doing pure functions, there's a lot of things that we can learn from the type signatures of the functions that we apply. So in this case, the feed animal function might have type animal of weight to okay. animal of weight, where weight will be a specific type. Mm-hmm. If that makes any sense,
that
right?
That makes sense, yeah.
Okay, whereas the runover method, well, it just so happens running an animal over does not affect the weight, right? Mm-hmm. So it will have a type that says animal of A, where I don't care what the A is, will go in and animal of A will come out. Mm-hmm. So that means looking at the type signature, I already know, just looking at the type signature, not looking at the implementation and with no documentation at all, that tells me that running over an animal does not affect its weight at all.
Because you don't depend on the type parameter.
Yeah, okay. Because the function doesn't know anything about the type, mm-hmm. right? Whereas the feed animal, it might not, but it probably does because it says a concrete type there for the weight. Moreover, of course, that feed animal function can be implemented with map, with the map function that we've just defined, right? And so that would be a simple example how to look for where the value, where you derive a small value from finding a functor. So that's another worthwhile thing you can do. And it certainly leads to even more surprising results when it's successful than finding a combinator.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Other things to discover in this regard?
So once you have a functor, right, you have a type variable. So you start with looking for the type variable, as Lau says. Then you look for the functor, and then there's a hierarchy that goes up from there, that we and that culminates. You always listen for the M word, right, the monad word. Mm-hmm. So for a monad, you need a functor. You start with a functor, and then there's additional properties and equations that you discover, and ultimately you end up with a monad. And in between, there are several other terms. So I don't think it makes sense to discuss them, but to discuss what they are, but they are useful. So there's something called an applicative functor, or we sometimes just say applicative. There's something called an arrow, and there's various variants of that in between. Mm-hmm. And the cool thing, again, about these is that they all each of them supports specific operations like map. So for example, a monad will have something, an operation that sort of an old-style functional programming we would call bind, but these days it's often called flat map. And you find flat map in the Java standard library, again, in different places. Mm-hmm. And it also has some equations that describe how flat map should behave. And based on these sort of simple operations that are immediately connected with these abstractions, is you can build libraries of more useful but very general abstractions. And so again, that gives you tools to think about your domain. So if you discover a monad in your domain, it does happen occasionally, that you discover a monad, then immediately it sort of raises the question, oh, what's the flat map operation? Usually you find the monad by finding the flat map operation, but monads have a join operation, right? And a join operation says, for example, well, the typical join operation on lists would be if you have a lists of A. Mm-hmm. Right. If you have nested lists, you can just append all these lists into one. Mm-hmm. Right. And so you take the lists of A, and you can get from that a simple list of A with no nesting. But above all, it raises the question, well, what does it mean to be a list of A's? Or does that concept even map to something? And when you find that domain in your domain, you know, you think of, well, what does it mean to be a something of something of something? So one classic example, again, is of images, right? If you generalize images using this idea of looking for the functor, you generalize over sort of what's in the pixels and put the type parameter there where the color of the individual pixels is. And you get up to monad, and when you get up to monad, you raise this question, oh, but now I have images of images where there's an entire image in each pixel, if you will. That, again, leads to useful ways to thinking about your domain.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
and what's important really is that I think what's important is that these things I can write them down in a functional language because of their abstraction capabilities. So I can define what a functor is, at least what the operation's type signature is, And for example, in Java, I can't write it down, so I've got to put it in a comment. And having these things at my fingertips in the language really not just enhances what I can do in the when I program, but it also enhances what I can do in my brain.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if I understand your argument correctly, what you're saying is there is this there is a different domain, actually a rich domain of the mathematics or the patterns underlying functional programming, mm-hmm. functional modeling. And if you bring that knowledge to a different domain and mm-hmm. merge the two of them, you actually yeah. can see where there are interesting things that could happen. I find that very convincing. Okay. Very good. So is that the same thing as what you call denotational domain-driven design, or is that a different beast?
Yeah, that's the beginning of that idea. So the general idea of denotational domain-driven design is that you look for a representation of the entities in your domain, and then you look for mathematical properties of those objects. And so denotational domain-driven design really puts a heavy emphasis that you create, that you try to come up with a representation mainly with the methods of mathematics, right? And you know, given the fact that mathematics really is the primary tool that for many centuries humanity has had for modeling the hard facts of the world around us. And you don't necessarily look to it with an eye of creating a concrete implementation. It just so happens that because functional programming languages use mathematical ideas in their structures, you can often implement those ideas anyway. So coming back, for example, to that classic image example, a cool representation you can use for images is just a function that will translate coordinates into a color. Mm-hmm. Right, as opposed to you know an array of pixels or something like that. So that's an idea that's very mathematical. It's not geared towards you know producing pictures on the screen at all, even though you can make it do that. And so, if you do that, if you map it into the world of sort of mathematical constructs, then usually we have at our disposal this rich, this rich set of things that we can look for. This rich set of properties, and these include things like functor or monoid, or something like that. But denotational domain-driven design means you look for that representation. That representation is called a denotation, which is why it has that name. And then you look for properties. Denotational domain-driven design, I think, adds one more element in that. A lot of mathematical abstract structure already has a lot of properties. To name one example is that if you have to make it very concrete, right, is in if you have the option type in Java, right, it's an option of A, mm-hmm. And it might have something in it or not. So that A might form a monoid. You might be able to combine two A's into one. And so if the A's form a monoid, then you can make option of A also into a monoid. So the structure will sort of fall out. You just say option and you immediately know what its structure is like as a monoid. And so there's a lot of structure there. So functions have a lot of structure. You know, just compound data where you create tuples have a lot of structure. And in mathematics, we have a library of the structure that these various mathematical constructs have that we can immediately draw upon. So we don't even need to look sort of, well, how could we make a monoid out of this thing? Instead, we just construct our domain denotation in such a way that the monoid will be obvious and implicit in the construction. Mm-hmm. And so that sort of gives, you know, it really dials the abstraction, you know, one level higher. And will often allow us to discover even more stuff about our domain by mapping, you know, these abstract things back into the domain. Mm-hmm.
Very cool. Okay, so I think we've sort of reached our time limit. Mm-hmm. I'm sure we could continue for about 25 hours very easily, but we won't. Instead, I would mm-hmm. like to ask you, are there some resources that you can point our listeners to? What's a good way to start if one wants to find out more?
Yeah. If you really want to start out in functional programming, then I've got a shameless plug. If you sort of Google for my name, you will come to a page called DynProgramm, which is a program I've been running for many years.
We'll add that to the show notes,
German,
of course.
For German speakers. Mm-hmm. So in a former life, I actually did a lot of research on teaching how to program, and you know, surprised that ended up being related to functional programming as well. And there is a lot of free material. In particular, there's a book I'm currently rewriting and will hopefully finish in the next couple of months, where you can always get the current PDF for free from that website. There's also, so the Racket system that I mentioned earlier, it really originally was conceived as a system for teaching how to program. So you can download that, and it comes with special teaching languages for functional programming. So that's a great way to get started. So I think that's, and it also has a lot of links. I think in general, after you've looked at the material there, you're probably going to be interested in a particular functional language, and then really a not too bad approach is to just look at the home pages for any of those languages, which will typically have at least a tutorial and some more comprehensive documentation of what goes on there. And there's lots and lots of books. Mm-hmm.
What about the modeling side of things?
Yeah, well, good point. So there's not as much there as I would like. So so a lot of sort of the modeling folklore that I talked about in this podcast actually comes from scientific papers. So a lot of sort of the knowledge that we have how to write functional programs were really driven by the research community and published at research conferences and research journals. And that unfortunately means that a lot of books on functional programming sort of focus on programming in the small and not so much sort of on really real-world domain modeling. So I think there's a wonderful book by Scott Vlashin called Domain Modeling Made Functional. I think that goes in that direction, which I like, which shows how to sort of link the concepts from domain-driven design and do that in F#. But sort of for the higher level modeling stuff that I just described, there's no book yet. And so I guess I'm going to have to write one after the
one
is done. Yeah.
Very good. Thanks a lot, Mike. It was awesome talking to you. I learned a lot, yeah, which is always great.
It was my pleasure too. Thank you very much.
And thanks to our listeners for listening. Until next time. Bye-bye.
Yes. Bye.